Friends, last week we considered something of the issues of belonging and grace and church. And this morning we are going to consider something else related to these issues. What the author Philip Yancey simply calls ungrace. And we're going to do so partly by considering a story in the Bible that I don't think I've ever preached about, or may simply have touched on in one of my messages. It's a rather strange story, it's a shocking story, and it's a story that has immense depth, one of those stories that, although ancient, has much to teach us and much to remind us about. Ungrace is a word that Yancey uses because it's very clear in its meaning. It simply means the opposite of grace, or living in a state where grace is absent. A state which occurs if we continuously choose to only think of ourselves in a selfish way and never open our eyes or have our eyes opened to see beyond. Our story for this morning is found in the book of Genesis chapter 4. Now the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have produced a man with the help of the Lord. Next she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. In the course of time Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel for his part brought of the firstlings of his flock their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering. But for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. Cain said to his brother Abel, let's go out to the field. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is your brother Abel? He said, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it will no longer yield to you its strength. You will be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. Cain said to the Lord, My punishment is greater than I can bear. Today you have driven me away from the soil, and I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. And anyone who meets me may kill me. And the Lord said to him, not so. Whoever kills Cain will suffer a sevenfold vengeance. And the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who came upon him would kill him. And Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Amen. Now, I think you'd all agree that this is an intriguing story. Mostly, I think when people think about the story, they think that what it's about is about murder. After all, Cain rose up against his brother and killed him. And the truth is that although a murder was committed, the first murder in the Bible, the story in actual fact deals with what gave rise to the murder in the first place. And when we delve into it, we realize that this isn't only a lesson for people who may want to murder and do terrible things. It's a story for every person. And it speaks to that which lurks within us if we live in a world of ungrace. The story tells us what can happen to us as human beings if we let resentment and jealousy and anger grow within us without these things ever being checked. One of the things about the story is that there's ambiguity in it. There's place for puzzlement. We aren't really told why God preferred Abel's sacrifice to Cain's. But we are told what happened when Cain's offering was rejected. Cain murdered his brother Abel. He killed him in cold blood. Reasons why things happened the way they did are difficult to find, but perhaps there is a clue in the writing. When God noticed how angry Cain became when his offering was rejected, God said to him, "Why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted?" So perhaps God looked at Cain, at the state of Cain's heart, and found it wanting. Perhaps God looked into Cain's heart and what God saw was displeasing. Unlike his brother Abel, perhaps Cain's motives were a little impure. Whatever the case, when God rejected what Cain brought to him or brought to him in offering, Cain's anger knew no bounds. With great resentment and jealousy in his heart and great anger towards God for rejecting his offering, Cain reacted. And he did so by projecting his resentment and jealousy, his anger and frustration outward to what he believed was the object of God's affection, his poor brother Abel. Put another way, Cain didn't listen to God. He didn't go away and think something like, "Next time I'll do better. I'll do everything in my power to please God and bring a sacrifice or an offering worthy of the name." Instead, he chose to spite God. And because Cain had no way of killing God, he sought to destroy the next best thing, the one who seemed to be close to the heart of God, his brother Abel. Abel lived in the grace of God, and his heart was good. Cain lived in an atmosphere of ungrace, and his heart became corrupt. Now we might hear the story of Cain and Abel, and we might think it has nothing to teach us because we would never do what Cain did. And we would be unwise to think this. Because when God's grace is absent or forgotten and ungrace abounds, what we might believe to be completely inconceivable has an odd way of rearing its ugly head. If not manifesting itself in something like murder, then wreaking havoc in other ways. Just think about it. Every single atrocity that has ever taken place on planet Earth has been caused by human beings. Every atrocity that has ever occurred has been committed by people, often by people like you and like me. Now, how many of you have heard of the Stanley Milgram experiments? One person so far. These were experiments carried out in the 1960s in an effort to figure out how it was possible for what happened in Germany during the Second World War with regards to the Jews and the people of that place. How was it possible for the most educated, wealthiest people in Europe to let the Nazis get away with the murder of millions of Jews? Milgram wanted to see how people reacted to following orders from a figure in authority, whether they would simply listen to orders and carry them out, or whether their consciences would come into play. And participants were led to believe that they were participating or assisting in an unrelated experiment in which they had to administer electric shocks to a learner. And these electric shocks, which were fake, unbeknownst to the person administering them, gradually increased in intensity to levels that would have been fatal if they had been real. And people from all walks of life were chosen. And the experiment eventually took place in other countries besides the United States. Well, that was included as well. That's where it started. And to add to it, the person asking the questions and doling out the shots with the prompting of an authority figure was told that the person answering the questions had a heart condition. So bear that in mind. And before the experiments began, Milgram asked experts like psychologists and psychiatrists for their predictions. 40 psychiatrists predicted that after the 10th shock, most people would simply stop the experiment. They also predicted that by the 300-volt shock, when the victim refused to answer, only 3.73% of the subjects would continue, and that little over 0.1% of the subjects would administer the highest shock on the board, which was a massive 450 volts. The experts were wrong in their predictions. They themselves were in for a shock because 65% of the participants administered the highest shock, a massive 450 volts, while all the participants, every single one of them, administered the 300 volt shock. And some subjects admittedly did what they did, showing signs of great stress. They sweated and they trembled and they stuttered. Some bit their lips and groaned. Some even had laughing fits. And every participant paused at least once during the experiment. But the fact is, the majority of people did what they were told. Stark authority was pitted against the subject's strongest moral imperatives against hurting others, Milgram wrote. And with the subject's ears ringing with the screams of the victims, which were false screams, authority won more often than not. The extreme willingness of adults to go to almost any lengths on the command of an authority constitutes the chief finding of the study and the fact most urgently demanding explanation. Ordinary people simply doing their jobs and without any particular hostility on their part, can become agents in a terrible destructive process. Relatively few people, despite fundamental standards of morality, have the resources needed to resist authority. Now, none of us may commit a murder or even want to commit one, but the story of Cain and Abel, not just being about murder, teaches us what happens when ungrace rules the world. When people seek not to sort out their own frustrations, nor to seek forgiveness and healing in bad relationships, nor to question what might be injustice, but instead believing themselves to be superior or right, take out their anger and their resentment and their jealousy on someone else, find a scapegoat to bear the burdens of life or to get back at God. In the Gospel, according to John, near the end of the Gospel, we find a gem, something fascinating, and something that could almost be a throwaway story were it not so important for us to consider. And there we find Jesus and Peter and some of the other disciples on a beach. And they've just had breakfast, and Jesus has just reinstated Peter by asking Peter how much he loves him, how much Peter loves Jesus. And Jesus has just told Peter that he will have the responsibility to feed and to tend Jesus' sheep. And then we read this. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. He was the one who had reclined next to Jesus at the supper and said, "Lord, who is it that is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, "Lord, what about him?" And Jesus said to Peter, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? Follow me." In other words, he might have said, "Mind your own business. Think about the quality of your own life and your own heart, and keep your eyes focused on me. In the parable of the prodigal son, in the story of the older brother, we witness the same kind of thing that we witness in the story of Cain and Abel. In fact, I believe the story of Cain and Abel is the basis for the parable. You see, the older brother has always towed the line. It never shamed his father. It never left home. It never sowed his wild oats with prostitutes. And yet he was as mad as hell and brimming with resentment, blaming everyone but himself for the terrible life that he had. In other words, on the surface, it all might have seemed well. But underneath and in reality, the older son lived in a world of ungrace. A world of ungrace mostly because of his own doing, just like we witness in the story of Cain and Abel. And for all intents and purposes, his life was a lie. And because he wasn't prepared to admit it, his resentment and anger grew day by day and week by week and month by month, until the actions of his brother and the depth of his father's grace towards his brother became a platform for him to vent all the bile that was living in his soul. And boom, he exploded with hatred. When we turn to ourselves, we realize something, that we have choices to make. We can say this is a tough world to live in, and we don't understand why a lot of what happens in terms of suffering happens, and we can choose to live in a spirit of ungrace, full of anger and resentment and blame towards others and to God. Or we can say, this is a tough world, and there are a lot of things that are completely perplexing, things that we might never understand, and choose to live in the grace of God, seeking not to blame everything that happens on others or on God, but in grace doing good, living lives that seek to build up instead of tearing down, understanding life as sacred, not the focal point of our rage. Seeking to see beyond, to see the other side, not just that which stands before us and is easy to attack. Grace gives us the ability to rise above the suffering in our lives and also in the world, to look beyond and to live in hope, to not see ourselves as victims, seeking to blame everyone and everything besides ourselves, and to bring some well-needed goodness into the world. Grace allows us to look at our own lives honestly and ask questions about our responsibilities. Jordan Peterson, in his book about the 12 rules for life, tells the story of the hurricane that hit New Orleans a number of years ago. I can't remember exactly when that occurred. Hurricane Katrina was her name, right? And Peterson asked the question, was it a natural disaster? Of course, the weather was natural. Hurricanes, we know, happen in nature. But he asked the question, did New Orleans have to disappear underwater? And he answers that question with a no. The Dutch, he says, prepare their dikes for the worst storm in 10,000 years. Had New Orleans followed their example, no tragedy would have occurred. It's not that no one knew, he adds. The Flood Control Act of 1965 mandated improvements in the flood control system. Work, listen to this, that was supposed to be completed in 1978. Yet 40 years later, only 60% of the work had been done. Willful blindness, Peterson contends, and corruption took down that city. A hurricane, we might say, is an act of God, but failure to prepare when the necessity for preparation is well known, well, that is sin. That is a failure to hit the mark. And if you read the story of the ancient Jews as found in their scriptures, you cannot fail to notice that when things went wrong, most of the time they blamed themselves. They understood the goodness of God as self-evident, yet understood that their actions or their lack of them, the way that they lived, had consequences. And when they suffered, it was mostly through their own doing. And in order to dig themselves out of the hole of suffering, they had to make that which was wrong right, and they had to trust in God. They had to move from a state of living in ungrace to a state of living in grace. Now let me finish before I use up my 5,000 words for the day. I think that's what males get. I think it's fair to say that we live in a blame culture. It seems to me that people are always looking for someone else or something to blame when things go wrong. That nothing can go wrong without someone or something having the finger of blame pointed at them. And so we live in a constant state of ungrace. One brimming with resentment and jealousy and anger. A world of toxic relationships. Well, perhaps we need to look at ourselves before we begin to cast stones. Perhaps we need to remove the logs from our own eyes before we try and take the specks out of the eyes of others. Perhaps we need to rejoice in the gift of God's grace rather than letting ungrace destroy us in an atmosphere that brings out the worst in us and not the best. Cain and Abel isn't simply a story about murder, about fratricide. It's a lesson about what happens when we let resentment and anger, no matter how big or small, rule our hearts. When we let ungrace define us. Amen.